I don't know if you saw the news last month, but one of the world's top cancer centers, the Harvard-affiliated Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, retracted 6 research papers and issued corrections to 31 more after a blogger showed that they had been falsifying their data.
Well, a Harvard teaching hospital is in hot water after revelations that at least 37 of its publications may contain false information.
Well, maybe falsifying is the wrong word. What happened is that their papers were full of images, of stains, of Western blots, and microscopic slides that also appeared in other parts of the paper with different captions that indicated different results.
Well, perhaps the histology slides weren't very consistent, so they've decided to show just the same tumor sample over and over again and hope no one's noticed.
It was a pretty major scandal because, well, Dana-Farber and its charity, the Jimmy Fund, is the 17th largest charity in the world, with an annual revenue of $1.7 billion a year. Starting in 1947, they pioneered the first effective cures against leukemia. So a lot of people depend on them for hope and maybe one day the cure for cancer, which is why the data fraud is so stunning. But that, it's just the tip of the iceberg. Sholto David is an out-of-work molecular biologist with a PhD from Newcastle University. He lives in Wales, and his hobby is taking down rampant scientific fraud all across the internet. He's just 32 years old and has basically no resources behind him, and yet Sholto seems to find fraud everywhere he goes. Because of his efforts and other people at the website PeerPub, where he posts his findings, the February 2024 issue of the prestigious journal Bioengineering dedicated 90% of its page space to retractions. He has personally flagged more than 2,000 papers with sham data, and it makes me wonder, what on earth is going on in the halls of science? Why is he one of the only people looking at this? And what does this all mean for the credibility that we have in scientific discovery? Anyway, I knew I had to have him on the show, and I wanted to point you to his YouTube channel and blog where he posts his results. And I've got links down in the show notes. There's also, it also appears in the pinned comment if you're watching this on YouTube. So go hit those links and then meet us back here. We'll wait. I first want to congratulate you on the impact that you're having in what I guess amounts to an internet hobby. Can you give me a broad overview of what you see as your scientific mission at the moment?
Yeah, a broad overview, I guess I'm interested in image errors. I'm interested in reading scientific papers carefully in my own way and critically, and I have been for a few years. I think if there is a mission, it's just to find interesting things, start discussions, and some of that is just purely out of, I think, curiosity, and you know, a desire to interact and communicate with other scientists. And these are people I normally wouldn't get to talk to, and you know, usually they don't reply to me anyway. But it's certainly a way to interact with research for someone like me who's not otherwise really a successful researcher.
And you know, what are the stakes here? Like, you know, how did you get into this, and why are you actually doing this? Other than maybe the social side of this, it feels like there's a mission.
I don't want to play up that. It's not social so much as just the. You know, I think a lot of scientists probably understand the desire to write letters, to engage in disputes, to point to things that they find are wrong, right? Science is supposed to be self-correcting. So I'm going around doing a bit of correcting, I suppose, is the way that I would see it. I don't see it necessarily as likely to have a large impact myself. You know, people are really excited about this, I suppose. For me, I just enjoy writing, and I used to write letters to the editor, but these weren't often published, or it would be quite a long process. So now I write blogs and I write for PubPeer. I guess that's it. It's just a general interest and a motivation. And of course, I'd like to see mistakes corrected. That's always good. I like to see mistakes, and I like to identify, you know, more serious things, like things that I would consider to be fraud. That's a really interesting to identify it. And I think about the animals and the people involved in this research, it does seem important, but I don't want to paint that as like my heroic motivation. I think there's something a little bit more, people can understand, right? Just an interest in finding mistakes in other people's work, right? Everyone likes that, right? Surely. I hope everyone does. I think most people at least understand why that would be enjoyable to a certain type of personality, right?
Sure. I mean, as an investigative journalist, I sort of get that. Like, I'm poking holes in people's statements sort of professionally for my whole career. But at the same time, like, I think you're underselling the important role that you actually have here. I mean, someone like Dana Farber, who you really, really went in deep on, and you've also looked at, there's a series of Pakistani researchers that you looked at a few months ago as well. These people are posting scientific research that is supposed to ostensibly heal people at some point, right? This research is supposed to build up a case, build up actual therapeutics that help. And then what you are finding in your research is reused and essentially fake data, and that does matter. Like, I know that you're trying to underplay it, but it does. Like, at least for me, it matters that these institutions are putting something out there that may not be real.
Yeah, no, I don't dispute that it matters, and I think it is something that people probably should be concerned about. Right, it's not the behavior you expect when you donate money to scientists or towards research. I think people have an expectation that scientists would take a lot of care, and some of the stuff that I found is more careless than it is definitely fraud, and some of it is obviously fraud. And it's also just worth mentioning, and I keep trying to mention, is that a lot of the stuff that was in the blog and the problems I sent to Dana-Farber were found by other people, anonymous accounts. And then I've gone back again recently to look at the images myself more carefully and found a lot more stuff. So this particular project on Dana-Farber is a combination of other people's work and my own. I'm one of the most prolific, I think at the moment at least, people who comment on image problems, but I'm certainly not the most prolific. There are other people who are far more productive than me. Smut Clyde, Elizabeth Bick, Cheshire on Twitter, and I kind of can't name because then I'd be missing people out. There's a few, but there's a lot of people involved in this, interested in this. It matters. I hope people care about it. At the same time, I kind of would do it to all and any institutions, right? Like, it's interesting and it's Dana-Farber, but I'm also quite, all papers matter, I suppose, to me for my own interests. Well, like you said, I also look at Pakistani researchers or Chinese researchers. I have a lot of different things that I'm interested in looking at.
How much would you say is this just sloppiness, like, sort of like errors that are maybe not completely honest, but are not the worst things in the world? How much of that is outright fraud, would you say, that you're coming across?
Yeah, that's really hard to know, isn't it? And there's papers which are in the Dana-Farber kind of collection, and the first 50 or so I sent them, they said they would retract 6. And those retractions haven't all appeared yet, but that was their intention. And I suppose, 6 out of 50 probably points to roughly the level of really serious stuff. And then there's 31 or so corrections. And then the 16 or 17 other ones were with different institutions, and there was one they said they disagreed with me on. And that seems about fair. Maybe in the stuff that I flag, 6 to 30 serious to less concerning. Obviously I look at a lot of papers where I don't flag anything, right? So there's a whole denominator here, which isn't often discussed. And I have done a little bit of formal stuff where I've looked at all of the papers in one journal, for example, and I found image problems in about 15% of the papers in that journal, which had a picture I could check. So, that would give you an idea of the ballpark. It's in the lower percentages of papers that have problems. And then when you look at that split, some percentage of those are really serious ones, which would amount to either egregious errors or fraud. And then when you get to these really kind of, scientists who make a lot of simple mistakes, that in itself is concerning, right? Because there's only so many whoopsies, I think, that one person can accumulate. And I guess it's important, right, that mistakes happen and that should be acknowledged. And that we should fix mistakes, and that's also part of it, right? I don't don't want to pretend that you, clearly if you look at anyone's work, if they've worked, done enough work, you're going to be able to find mistakes eventually. But there's only so many, I think, you know, before it becomes a concern in itself. So I hope that, that gives you a rough idea of my perspective of it.
Sure. Well, what are the reasons do you think that a scientist might actually commit outright fraud? Like what are the incentives out there for maybe not the mistakes? Because I think we can understand that errors occur and errors. And that's actually why I would think that someone like something like PubPeer exists, right? You presume the person's being honest and they presume you're going to be honest and you're going to essentially do a second peer review on their work. And so the collegial attitude of science should prevail, right?
Yeah.
But there's also these instances where it's not quite like that. What would you say would be motivations for these, you know, more problematic papers to appear?
You know, there's been some surveys on this, and there are people who feel more confident to write about this. There is actual scientific research on scientific mistakes. You know, from the little that I know, I think there's going to be a mix, right? There's going to be where people have made up figures in ways that must be intentional. I think pressure to finish a paper, perhaps they're a more junior researcher, right? Some scientists are in precarious positions. I don't want to make too much of that, but if your visa application depends on publishing good work or prestigious work, you can see how easy that is. And then there are people who probably think they know the truth about what an experiment should show, and maybe this result didn't show exactly that. So they think, well, it's not really fraud because they're actually correct and it's okay just to shuffle these mice around to make it more impactful. Maybe they feel very confident in what they're doing. So I can see how, you know, they allow themselves to get ahead of the data in that way and simply think, you know, the data should just be corrected, if you get what I mean, into showing what it should show. I could see those kind of things happening. Yeah, some people just malevolent forces, right? They just don't care about getting things right at all, and they would go for anything to make themselves more money. And I suppose everyone is on that scale somewhere, right? Everyone chooses to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do when it benefits them. So it's complex, but there are serious cases which, you know, have been done by people who you'd think rather better of, I guess.
Yeah, you know, a few months ago, I had the opportunity to interview this guy named Dan Ariely. You've probably heard his name. I actually scheduled the interview long before I knew anything about fraud, and it was on the books right when his fraud thing was breaking. So it was like, I was like, oh my God, what are we going to ask this guy? You know, he's famous for something called the nudge, which is this idea that you give people little nudges, little like, you put an honesty pledge at the top of a car contract. And then by putting that honesty pledge at the top instead of the bottom, they're going to be more honest on the form. These nudges became pop psychology gold a few years ago, and, you know, even taken up by government programs. But it turned out that he probably faked the core data. He and Francesca Gino were caught up in this giant thing. And, you know, when I had this chance to speak with him, one of the things that got me is that he, you know, would say, oh, mistakes were made. Maybe there were some errors in the data. Maybe it wasn't my fault, even though his sign-in was used in the sheets where the data showed up. And he certainly played into the idea that this was just an honest error. On the other hand, I assume that from his consulting projects that he does with like Oracle and like Amazon and these, you know, these giant companies, probably bringing in a bunch of money. So it seems to me that there is quite potentially a serious incentive for these people to pick it out. And I also want to note that it was someone like you, you know, just a guy on the internet with a blog with a good scientific background who actually broke the story.
That's a good point to bring up. And I do think sometimes people get caught up in the idea that it's just publish or perish for scientists, right? It's just publish or perish, and they get forced into making bad decisions. There are big incentives. There's lots of money at the top of science for people running these large groups. And the compensation is really high, right? So there's the other end of the spectrum of scientists aren't necessarily pressured to do these things. They could run a more modest laboratory and do more modest and true projects, or they can kind of race to the top. And Laurie Glimcher is the CEO of Dana-Farber, and a couple of her papers I caught out. These were early papers of hers. And you know, the result of her publishing those early papers is no doubt important in developing her career. Now she's the CEO. She's on a salary of, it's about $4 million.
Oh my God.
It's those documents are open, by the way. I'll send you a link, because it's a nonprofit. They publish the salaries of the to leaders. So, you know, that it's hard to see her as a case of simply publish or perish, right? And all of her colleagues, a lot of her colleagues at least, are on, you know, very large salaries, $500,000 a year. So it is important to look at not just the kind of negative or incentives, but also that there are these, you know, there's big prizes at the top that tempt people. I think that kind of follows what you were talking about there about, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, your YouTube channel has this bit that's actually pretty funny. It's called Science Police, right? And you actually just sort of like put on like a policeman's uniform and are, you know, there's sort of like a kitsch factor to the, at least your intro here. But I think one thing that's really important to point out is that you're sort of playing in the internetosphere, right? You're playing at the level of YouTube up against these really giant respected institutions with billions, literally billions of dollars. And you're playing a vital role. And it's in the same way that a Wikipedia editor plays a vital role, or a Reddit moderator plays a vital role in keeping information flowing. But I think I'd like to, you know, just point out that you're doing this interview with me right now from a phase one clinical trial research organization, where you are currently on a phase one trial, not as a principal investigator, as somebody with a PhD. So is that like a call for like a mealtime or a pill or something
like
that?
Yeah.
Right. So this is the point. You are here at the bottom of the food chain, not as even a PI, not as someone who's getting paid, but you're probably getting paid, a few $1,000s to test a drug that may have been based on fake data. Like, do you see an irony here?
Yeah, no, of course, there's something, I think people would see that as strange, but, you know, I chose to give my job last year, and I actually was working at an institution like this. I was working as a scientist in the lab, and my most recent job, it was a principal scientist job, so not, you know, I've had serious scientific jobs, but at the same time, you know, for a while I haven't been working, and that's out of choice. I should say that I get a little bit of money on Patreon now. It's not much. It's £200 or £200 or £300 a month, which is doesn't make my electricity bill at the moment, let alone rent. So obviously I'm spending my savings at the moment, and that's why I've come to do a clinical trial, and I've done a few odd jobs and stuff, and I'm not in a desperate financial position, but I'm certainly not well off. And I don't really make, you know, a living from doing this, even remotely. And the YouTube channel has been, you know, expensive to me, if nothing else. I don't, you get the odd AdSense check every year. It's, you know, £60 or something, but I spend money on that. And yeah, you know, it is the case that I do this out of interest and motivation for the reasons I said before, just purely for interacting and for the interest of reading papers and finding mistakes. Maybe it has to be that way, right? It does concern me that people want to suggest more funding for science sleuths, and maybe that's good. That's on them. But for me personally, I don't know if I'd want this to be a job, and I don't know if it would suit me well if it was. Maybe having people motivated out of interest rather than any other reason is the best way to get some things done. And I don't, maybe, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't want to speak to anyone else, because it could be the case that it's really worth, probably is worth funding some people. But for me, I think part of the interest here, and maybe part of what keeps me engaged is knowing that it's, you know, it's not a lucrative thing. It's because I'm interested, because I care about doing it, right?
That's interesting. It sounds like you really have the idealistic notion of the early internet, like embedded in your soul, which is actually very admirable, because the internet, when it sort of first showed up, really was a volunteer organization. It really was about people coming together, sharing just web link, hyperlinks back in the, you know, the early 90s. And still the internet, most of the reliable stuff on the internet is done as on a volunteer basis. And yet there is this irony, right? There is this irony that you are holding truth to power. You're another person out there holding truth to power. And the fact that, like, literally billion-dollar organizations have to respond to somebody who makes a living you know, who's basically out of work and selling their blood on a clinical trial. I mean, the irony here is I am just reveling in the irony here, because I've actually been in somewhat the same position as you. When I began my career as an investigative journalist, my first story was being in a CRO. That's a contract research organization, right? Where I tested the erectile dysfunction drug Levitra, where they gave me the maximum dose of Levitra to see if a human could tolerate it. I did. And there was also the placebo, and I knew when I was on the placebo and when I wasn't, because there's a dowsing rod involved in this particular thing. But it also turned out that those CROs, you know, I did actually write about this for a local newspaper, and I did make a little bit of money, a few thousand dollars on the trial and my work. But these drugs, like Levitra, like whatever you're testing right now, what drug are you testing right now? Can you describe it? You don't need to give a brand
name. I don't know.
Do you even know what it does?
I know what it's roughly for. I don't know. I haven't checked the conditions of this particular CRO. So I'm going to say, you know, I won't say, but I haven't really researched it very carefully, and I'd rather not. You know, I'd rather not look too carefully, because I don't want to upset myself.
Sure, but nonetheless, you are a test pilot. You're sort of like those guys who were trying to break the sound barrier at the first time, and of course, you're testing it, meaning that, you know, you might, it's probably going to be fine, because there's already testing before you get there on animals and such. But yeah, they are probably, if you're phase one, you're testing the maximum dose tolerable.
I'm one of the phase one group, so it will be one of the first people to have it. And I think, as far as I understand, you know, it will be a typical phase one trial. They'll have several groups perhaps and increase the dose as you go, and I don't know exactly which group I'm in. I haven't looked it up, but yes, it is a very early stage, and this will be some of the first testing that happens on healthy volunteers right before they test it with people who may have the condition. But yeah, I shouldn't give too many details away, but for those, you know, since you're curious, just to circle back to your discussion about you know, the early stages of the internet, I was a very very enthusiastic contributor to Yahoo Answers. So I loved Yahoo Answers. It's gone now. Wasn't a lot of truth on Yahoo Answers. Don't know if I wrote a lot of truth either. but I enjoyed it very much. And, you know, it's another user-generated website, right? Like PubPeeris, right? It's people writing answers and writing about things that they're interested in. It's those kind of projects and websites are interesting to me. I probably would be on Wikipedia more. I've always found that the syntax a little hard to get my head around. So I've never edited Wikipedia much, but those kind of things certainly interest me, yeah.
So here's the thing about citizen journalism. There are billion-dollar powers out there who are committing fraud, who are, you know, spreading misinformation, who are committing crimes. And, you know, the people who actually hold those big powers to account are not usually the best funded organizations in the world, which is why I'm interrupting this broadcast to ask you to come over to Patreon and support the sort of journalism that I do here on this channel. I've just updated it, so there's actually multiple levels where you can, you know, get early access to all my videos, but also archives of videos that I no longer have online. And your support means the world. Also, leave a comment down below. Like, subscribe. And if you're catching this on my podcast, which actually runs without ads on Spotify, even with these videos, you know, leave a review, leave some stars there, because that matters. Because when you're scrolling through your feed of potential podcasts, you know, if something has a lot more ratings than something that doesn't have ratings, well, you're more likely to click on it. And anything you could do to help spread the word about this channel, I appreciate it. So without further ado, back to the interview of another guy who's holding power to account. So in your citizen sleuthing, as you were, you know, what are the hallmarks of a fake scientific paper? You know, when you go in there and you're trying to look for something, how do you start, you know, how does your nose start going like, wait a minute, let's go look more?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. I look at different strands of research. So the stuff that kind of triggers me when I look at a paper published by Dana-Farber is going to be really different to something which comes out of China, or, you know, that's very broadly, but which comes from something like a Chinese paper mill, which is a paper just generated for the sake of publishing and enhancing career. So there's going to be really different things you'll look at depending on what the paper is. And I look at clinical trials as well, and I less frequently do that because it takes a lot longer. So again, if you're looking at a clinical trial compared to research on animals or in cells, that's going to be different. You know, I look at the images mostly, and I also have access to some software, which is called Image Twin. It's very powerful software for detecting duplicated images or duplicated parts of images. But I've been doing this for much longer than I've had Image Twin. So maybe the first 1,000 or so comments I wrote mostly about images were without Image Twin. And then I've been using Image Twin for the last maybe 8 months or something. And I've written another 1,000 or so comments since then. The things I'm going to be looking at are just the images a lot. Just look very carefully at the pictures and see if there are any similar areas or overlapping areas. And I might sometimes look at the statistics to check that they make sense, that they're possible, right? If you've got, here's a really simple example, right? Say the clinical trial says they recruited 50 people, and then you go to table one and it says they have 30 women and 30 men. Well, that's 60, right? So it's more than the number they say they recruited. So that's a red flag, right? If the simple things don't add up within the paper, because often when you're looking at a paper, you can just check it for internal consistency, right? You can only check for contradictions a lot of the time. Other things you might look at are some of the reagents they've used. It's very common to use short nucleotide sequences called primers for experiments involving qPCR. So that might sound like a mouthful. Remember, we had COVID testing not long ago, so I think people are pretty familiar with qPCR, right? You had to give your nails a swab, and there's this test they do to find the virus sequence, right? So you can check for short sequences of nucleotides and check they make sense against databases. So you can check for some external consistency with known things. So there's lots of different things that I might be interested in looking at. Another thing you might consider is like the timeline. Let's say a paper says they recruited 20 people, they followed them for 3 years, and they tell you the date that they started, but they published before that. They've published before their last data collection, right? So there's all kinds of odd inconsistencies that people have been able to pick up on, and eventually you kind of collect a range of things that you might decide to check when you look at a paper. But the vast majority of my comments are just looking at the images, just seeing if I've got an image which shows experimental condition A and an image showing experimental condition B. Maybe it's some cells that they've treated with two different drugs. And if I can see some of the same exact cells in the corners overlapping, well, it's clear that it was the same original microscope view. It's the same field of view. These cells were in the same container. They're not treated with different things. I hope, does that make sense?
No, it does. It sounds like such a rookie move by them to I mean, it sounds like, you know, you put an image in a paper to be like, look, we have data, right? That it's the look, we have data. And then you said, no, but I'm going to actually look at the data. Not just the fact that you have, like, I have looked at a lot of scientific papers and most of it's gobbledygook to me, right? You see a graph of, you know, with two acronyms on the X and Y axis and a bunch of dots. And you're like, well, I guess it's fine. You sound like a good guy. And you're actually looking and you're like, wait, no, they're just using they're just moving the frame over a quarter of an inch on the from the results to from the test subject to the results. And that's weird. That's like you don't actually have it. And in the case of Western blots, right, which is it's the actual final data, right, in a Western blot.
So when we talk about Western blots, these are these scientific diagrams. They look like a kind of gray background, normally with some black smudges on them. And those are images showing the presence or absence. And sometimes you can use it to kind of indicate the quantity of a protein in a sample. And yeah, I mean, that is an example of the raw data, right? When you do a Western blot, you're showing what you found in that particular sample. It's the raw data. Sometimes people might look at three different experiments and they might try and average the intensity of a Western blot and then try and plot that on a chart. But images, right, the reason that images are important and the reason they keep coming up is that sometimes these are going to be some of the only raw data that you'll see in a paper, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at a chart of people's weights, maybe you see the average, or maybe you see like some error bars or some bar charts, you're not actually seeing the values of all of the individual people in that trial, right? But the raw data is the most important thing. When it comes to like assuring your confidence in those meaningful results, right? Seeing the raw data is one of the most important things you can have access to, right? And so images are some of the only raw data that we might only see. And so that's, you know, something which has been more eloquently written by other people. That's important to think about. Why do images keep coming up and people think it might be odd? Why is it just looking at pictures? Well, pictures are some of the only raw data we have. And I do look at other types of raw data, like I said, if it's available. And I'm interested in all kinds of strange things. You mentioned like a scatter plot, right? I do sometimes analyze scatter plots. There's all sorts of mistakes you can find in scatter plots. For example, if you just imagine a very simple kind of scatter plot, which has, you know, like you said, the X and the Y axis, and it'll have a range of values 0 to 100, or, you know, and a range of values 0 to 200 on the other axis. Sometimes you'll find values that are impossible. Like, I don't want to think of any examples off the top of my head now, but if you gave someone a negative weight, for example, that would appear underneath the axis, right? Yeah, I was saying that there are sometimes if you look at a scatter plot, interpret the axes, sometimes you're going to find impossible values, right?
Yeah.
Maybe if you think about like a weight for a person as being far too large to be possible, or maybe negative. So you can certainly scrutinize things in more detailed ways than that. But you can imagine ways in which data is shown which is impossible or contradictory.
It's interesting. It seems like the basically what you're doing is looking for internal coherence in a lot of these papers. Do the claims match with the results, match with what you have, which is how you catch a liar, which is how I, as a journalist, I catch liars. I listen to people's actual words and I look for contradictions. That's how you check them. But the thing is, some people are actually just really good liars. Like, some people are like, they think through internal coherence, and there's no way that you can catch them with a coherence argument to get them, right? You need to get extra stuff, especially since it's not the norm in science to publish raw data. You know, like, what if that guy just wasn't good at analyzing raw data? Like, there's no way to know in almost all cases, which makes me think that the 2000 papers that you've looked at and the thousands more looked at PubPeer that have shown up are really just the tip of a scientific fraudulent or at least mistaken iceberg. And I'm not even sure how we go back in there and figure these out, and also rate how much of those errors are meaningful to like outcomes, because we don't really care about results, like internal coherence, if it's off, if at the end of the day the drug works, you know. So there's a lot of issues to sort through there. One thing that you did note is that you're using some AI software now to track data fraud. You know, and could you explain to me like what it is that you're doing to do this? And my follow-up question is, if there are these bad actors out there and you have the tools for AI, that does seem like there's an arms race between the two. Like, somebody could use AI to perpetuate fraud as well.
Yeah. Just to follow up on your point that you made there. Yes, it is the tip of the iceberg, right? There's a lot of things that you just can't check in most papers. You know, if someone didn't make a coherence error, as you described it, which is a good way to think about it, then it's very easy to make up data. It's very easy to fudge things, in some cases in ways that will not be found. I suppose we're usually blessed by, I think, at least in my opinion, liars might tend to be a bit more lazy. If they were motivated to do things correctly, they would probably just do research. So I think they do maybe tend to make more of these types of mistakes. But it is, like you said, it's unexamined, and I don't think there's any real way to know for sure. If you don't find a duplication, doesn't mean it's been labeled correctly. It just means you can't prove that it wasn't labeled incorrectly. So yeah, that's a really good point. It's important to think about. The software that I use, like I said, it's called Image Twin. It scans papers for images that look similar within that paper. And Image Twin also has a really good functionality to scan for papers elsewhere. So it has a library of previously published papers, open access papers, and it looks for those scientific images in those papers as well, which is really powerful for the kind of commercial type of fraud that we might expect to see. I keep mentioning China, but it is a problem that seems to originate in China. Paper mills, particularly in, for example, I'm very familiar with long non-coding RNA type papers, which is a field of biology research which has become really corrupt with papers which have just been manufactured by recycling images tens, maybe hundreds of times with rotations or kind of just. So Image Twin has this ability to look at previous papers and look within a paper. It's very powerful software for that. And is there an arms race potential for this? Yeah, of course, we're going to see generative AI making up figures now. But to be fair, there have been tools to make up images for a long time. You could have made images in Photoshop from scratch quite easily if you're motivated, but researchers tended not to do that, or at least the ones that I catch. So again, it's about how far will people go and how easy will it be to catch them? It's an interesting question, right? Like, a lot of the things that I find are very obvious. They are images which are exactly the same in the same paper, mm-hmm. labeled as different things. Will generative AI change much of that? Maybe, maybe not. People can check their own papers with Image Twin if they want. It's a service, right? You can pay for it. So, you know, they may be able to scan their own papers before they're published. So, you know, will that make their paper better or just make them take out the mistakes? Hard to know.
Well, it's one of the things that you noted, and I think is very true, is that liars are often lazy. Like if you look at the issue with Dan Ariely and Francesca Gino, it was clear that they just threw in round numbers for their fake data, right? And that was pretty easy to check. When you put in a stat plot, it looked like these were, instead of a mountain, it was a plateau. and it was obvious this was faked. The problem that I see with generative AI is that it does the work for you. It's like, you know, you can type into essentially the equivalent of ChatGPT for scientific fraud, and you can be like, give me realistic images of positive results for a Western blot. Boom. And it can create a unique image with low effort. And it's that combination, which to me is really, really scary, because it's going to be very easy to mass produce fraudulent data if you were a bad actor.
Just to follow up to that, yes, it's going to be harder to detect fraud as it happens new, right? But I think we are somewhat blessed in the scientific research kind of process that papers published, once they're published, don't change. So papers submitted today with generative AI, which is happening today, are going to be possibly quite hard to detect, but maybe 5 or 10 years down the line, we'll be able to roll back to a version of GPT and type in what kind of prompt they may have used and see what images it produced. And there'll be other ways, right? I'm sure there's smarter people than me looking up how to detect generated images. So because scientific papers are frozen in time, I'm somewhat optimistic there's going to be a fairly good detection rate on papers produced with generative AI in the near future. And, you know, it will be an arms race, but because of the kind of way that publishing works and papers being frozen, detection is going to stay hard at the point of publishing, but leave it 5 or 10 years, it'll get easier. And that's what's happening now with new kind of AI for detecting older, you know, image problems in older papers and new statistical ideas and techniques which have been applied to older papers that perhaps weren't done at the time. So I think there'll be a good opportunity to catch up, and we have, you know, leisure of time, I suppose, when it comes to detecting fraud, because those papers don't go anywhere.
Yeah. And I guess the nature of an arms race is that they get armed better, but you get armed better with the tools to do it, which I do think indicates, though, that people like you provide a necessary service in the world. And I still think that you guys are underfunded. Like, I know that you may do this out of the goodness of your heart, but I do think that there should be an institutional mechanism. In other arenas, there's this idea of an ombudsman, like a person in an institution who's there to check the facts and check reality. And it seems like ombudsmans are generally gone in the world. A lot of the official ombudsman's positions are gone, but that is the main check. Because when you are a peer, when someone comes to you with a peer review as a scientist, and a journal reaches out and says, hey, will you check this paper that was just submitted? I would think that very few of those peer reviewers automatically go to check for fraud. I would think that a lot of those peer reviewers assume the honesty of the paper that comes in and then will vet it based on different criteria. Whereas you're coming in and you're saying, but scientific fraud's a huge issue, man. Like, maybe it's out there. And then you find it after these had already escaped through the peer review issue. It seems like a necessary component of what the scientific method should have.
Yeah, I think you've grasped something important there, that peer reviewers aren't necessarily looking for simple mistakes like the ones I find, or more complex types of fraud. They, you know, probably, as you imagine, I don't peer review a lot of papers. I don't know if I've ever peer reviewed one. I've been asked a few times. You know, they're looking at different things. They're looking at methods or results in a way that in the don't expect to find these things. And when you don't look for something, you don't really find it. It really reminds me of that. There's that famous psychology experiment, which is actually quite informative, where you ask people to watch someone throw back, you know, a group of people throw a ball back and forth between them on a screen. And then you tell someone to count how many times the ball is thrown and the gorilla walks on the screen. And if you're focused on the counting, you don't see the gorilla. I don't know if you've ever seen that experiment. Mm-hmm. It fooled me. I didn't see the gorilla, right? And so I think that's the kind of issue which is happening when it comes to peer review. And people sometimes seem a bit astonished that, oh, how did this get through peer review? Well, it's not obvious until you're looking. You know, to come back to the idea of funding or doing something out of the goodness of my heart, I just find it a bit difficult to think and talk about, because there's some element of this in for me at least, which is maybe not really out of the goodness of my heart, right? I just do it because I like ensnaring other people in problematic discussions. Like, I don't know. Like, I just don't see it like myself as being necessarily positive in a lot of ways, and I'm just finding it hard to square that, because a lot of people have, oh, you're great, you're doing this great thing. Well, to be honest, you know, there's a different angle to this which I experience, which is I don't like the don't like the positive talk here. There's honestly, I do enjoy the drama and dragging people into addressing things that they don't want to talk about. That's fun for me. And I would do it for free. And, you know, people offering, you know, this idea of I should be funded for more. And that gives me this uncomfortable feeling that I would attack people for money, which is not true, because I do that for free. Right.
Well, you know, as an investigative journalist, I think that I struggle with the same questions quite a bit. Like, I'm not in it for the money, because there's a lot of better ways to make money in this world. On the other hand, I do think that it's important to be paid for my work. And I can square with the idea with the fact that I go out there and I will go into in front of a mob boss in I did this piece called The Godfather of Bangalore. I interviewed a mob boss, like, why'd you kill those guys in that courtroom? Because he shot four people in the courtroom. And then he said, it was like, five bullets, bang, 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 and I have them on the tape, right? So I do these things, which are even theoretically dangerous, and I do it for two reasons. One reason is because I want to be able to tell a good story, and I think I gel with you on the idea that I sort of like going in there and punching the big guy. Like, I like beating up the bully. On the other hand, I also like getting paid for my work, and I don't actually see a contradiction in that, because I don't get paid a lot. Like, I'm not looking for billions of dollars. I'm looking for a solid middle-class income. And I think that it's not crazy to assume that people should be paid for work that adds to the value in society. But I do see where you're coming from, because it can feel like, well, you know, you're not honest because you wanted to get paid for, you know, you wanted to get paid for doing something you wanted to do anyway.
I think this being problematic for me in that I've spent a lot of time pointing fingers at other people, right? You've made this mistake, you've made this mistake. And now, you know, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about myself, right? I'm also make a lot of mistakes, do things which aren't the right thing sometimes. Sure. And so it's not, you know, this, whereas before I was quite happily churning out hundreds, you know, comments on PubPeer, cheerfully, you know, jibing at other people, suddenly the publicity has not been necessarily good for me in some ways, because I'm thinking a lot about my own self and what I do right and wrong, and you know, I'm not making any confessions here, but just for the sake, just thinking about myself more broadly and situations where I could have made different choices. Of course, when you spend all your time pointing fingers and then people celebrate you as this, you know, I don't feel too celebrated mine, but there's been a few interviews and pieces and photos and you know, it causes me a bit of a struggle. I mean, if maybe you can understand that, but that's what I've been, you know, wrestling a bit with recently, and it's not necessarily.
Well, you know, in investigative journalism, one of the things that was always great were these people called fact checkers, who, when you're an opening reporter, when you're just starting out, you hate fact checkers, because you go out there and you're doing your work and the fact, and you found the thing and you're like, fuck yeah, I did this right. And the fact checker comes in and is like, well, I don't know, Scott, maybe you over pushed on this thing. And then, you know, the young Scott is like, I hate you, fact checker. I am right. Right. But then you get a little bit more mature and you're like, no, that fact checker is actually making me a better person. Like, that fact checker is actually making my work better. And that's one of the benefits of institutional support, honestly. That's like one of the beauties of these. You create a professional scheme where, you know, we all make errors. Like, I changed the name of my Substack from I think it was called like the Truth or something like that, to like Magnetic North being like, I get things pretty right. Like sort of like North is there, but I'm sort of at Magnetic North. And I think it's okay to admit that you can make errors because we all capable of that. On the other hand, at least you're trying. Unless, of course, what you're telling me is that you did something very duplicitous, which I don't think.
One thing I will say is that I make very few mistakes when it comes to scientific papers. I track my false positive. I track when I've accused someone of making a mistake and I've got it wrong. And it's, you know, of the 2,000 or so comments I've written, it's in 10, 20 comments that I would rather not have written. But no, I'm just thinking more broadly about myself and my personal life and stuff that, you know, just thinking a lot about errors and mistakes and choices people made and why people did this or why people fudge this figure, right? Fudging a figure, is that the worst thing that someone's done in their life? I've probably done worse things to other people than fudge a figure in a paper. So it's just, I'm spending a lot of time stressing about that at the moment. And it's part of the reason I'm not, you know, not totally enamored with the recent attention about this, because it's nice in some ways to, it's nice in fact to feel ignored, right? That's a nice thing. Like then you get a kind of sense of righteousness in about what you're going around doing. Like no one cares what I write, so I can write whatever I like, right?
Yeah.
No one cares who I write about, so I write about anyone. And then suddenly you feel a bit like, oh, people might read this, and that's an uncomfortable feeling that people read your blogs, right?
It's like someone just went through your Reddit history and figured out what your real name was.
I don't ramble on about this too much. I'm dragging the conversation away from the relevance.
Let me ask you one sort of final question, and it's I want to flip this whole conversation on its head. Let's say you were super villain Sholto David and your game was to make the perfect faked paper for maximum profit. What would you do?
Yeah, I mean, writing papers in itself doesn't make scientists money, so they need to make results which they can sell, right? And so I suppose you would want to maybe do a study, and then just, I think this is something Gino Franco's done, and maybe if you've done a study maybe on some people or some animals and you've collected a lot of data and you've got two groups and the groups you want to show difference between those groups, you probably do the whole study, collect all the data with your collaborators. It may not be very feasible to do that on a clinical trial in the West, at least, because these are going to be quite tightly regulated, but on maybe an animal study or something, or a psychology study, and then swap people between the groups. Reassign which group they're in. So that's how I think is the least detectable way to make fraud. And if you wanted to make money, it would need to be, a finding that people would relish to discover, something very relevant, something maybe to do with feminism, some kind of hot button issue, something unexpected. You know, there are psychology researchers who are genius at making up these titles. You think they probably do the title first and then write the paper after, come up with a good title for a paper and then do the study to afford it, right? I'm not very good at that, but I think, you know, the idea of switching individuals or measurements between groups, because then you don't make up any measurements, you just make up which group they're in when you measured it, is probably the best way to fake research. And then when it comes to images, I don't think it's too hard to avoid not duplicating images. You just need to check very carefully against the raw data. And if you wanted to make stuff up, it's pretty easy to do. Just mislabel your images, but don't also duplicate them. I guess that's my rough answer.
Okay, well,
it's a good question. It's a good question. Did you ask Dan?
No, I didn't ask Dan, but I should. I may send him an email now and just get the most hideous response. For it's funny, after I did that interview, he wrote me an email because he was very upset by my truncated analysis of the thing. And he was like, Scott, I think you did me a terrible job. I want you to convene a group of academics and journalists together to rate whether or not your work was fair to me. And I was like, I'm not going to, what are you talking about? And then when I heard that, I was like, okay. I mean, they're like, because when I'm talking to someone, I give people the benefit of the doubt. Like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to listen to you. And I'm not going to just like think you're an asshole to begin with. And he sort of had me on the edge that whole time. But when he, you know, his follow-up emails, I was like, oh, come
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy conflict with academics. They have a quite an interesting attitude sometimes on PubPeer, right? This is something I really like when people respond and their kind of perspective. And some of these people are people who are not used to being challenged at all, right? Especially not on the internet. So they don't appreciate the language. They don't appreciate the way it's done. They've got all these. Yeah. So this is something I do enjoy very much. And, you know, it always frustrates me when people choose not to respond. But there you go.
All right. So for everyone who's been listening, there is just so much more, so much deeper here. And I want you to go check out Sholto's work on the website For Better Science, which he contributes. He's also got this YouTube channel, which has some really funny bits where he dresses up as a policeman. And I don't know why you're swimming in lakes as you do this, but the intro is funny. It's got that sort of like... you know, this is sort of British humor to it, and you may enjoy. And so go check that out. And, you know, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate this conversation. And I think you provide a valuable service. And for people listening on Spotify, we're going to put a vote down at the bottom. And the vote is going to be, do you think Sholto David provides a valuable service to the world? Yes or no? All right. And then it'll be resolved. It'll be resolved at that point. So, okay. All right. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This was Scott Carney Investigates.